Good evening, my name is Eric, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Eric.
And grateful to be here. Always grateful to be anywhere to share my experience, strength, and hope with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and my personal journey in this thing called recovery. And I'm completely unprepared. I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth, and I have no idea where I'm going to go with this. And I'm going to allow God to kind of control me tonight rather than my ego. Right, and the human ego is what I fight with on a daily basis. It is my alcoholism, and although I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which means I don't have the obsession to drink anymore, I'm still recovering from my character, and that's a daily reprieve for me. And it's some things I need to keep in check. Otherwise, I will drink again if I don't. And my book's kind of beat up and falling apart, and. There was a blank page in this book at one point, and I remember sitting down with my sponsor, and he said, "This is exactly what you know about recovery. Nothing." And I had a sponsor who was, he said, "I'd rather step on your feelings than step on your grave." He wasn't worried about my feelings or hurting my feelings. He was more in the business of telling me the truth so I can recover. And, you know, honesty is where my recovery begins, self-honesty. And so I'm going to start actually in the forward to the first edition. And I'll probably skip around a bunch. It says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely," which means this is a textbook for me, this gives me some instructions, "precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book." And I like the word purpose. We read it, most meetings I go to, they read the preamble, and they say, "My primary purpose, stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety." I found over the years in recovery, you can put that statement in reverse. The more I'm here trying to reach out to other alcoholics and help them achieve recovery, my recovery is merely a byproduct of taking that action. I'm not coming to meetings today white-knuckling it because I need a meeting or I feel like drinking. I'm coming to meetings, as Dr. Bob would say, to duty and obligation. To give back what was so freely given to me. And so I have purpose today. Prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like I had no purpose. And it's truly a gift for me. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend the alcoholic as a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. It is important that we remain anonymous because we are too few at the present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this publication. Being mostly business and professional folk, we could not well carry on our occupations in such an event. We would like it understood that our alcoholic work is an advocation. When writing or speaking publicly about alcoholism, we urge each of our fellowship to omit his personal name, designating himself instead as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The traditions are amazing to me, and that's one of the traditions talks about Tradition 11, you know, press, radio, and films. And a lot of people get anonymity confused in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some people want to remain anonymous in AA. And my name's Eric Vaughn, and I'm an alcoholic, right? And it's okay to use your last name in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Have you ever tried to visit Joe the plumber in the hospital if you're sick? They look at you like you got 10 heads. And so I was taught that I'm not going to be anonymous in an AA meeting. There's no need to be anonymous. This is a safe place. This is where I can let a lot of things out. And this is where I can recover. And so there's no need for me to be anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so many members confuse the anonymity portion of the traditions in this the program and the fellowship. We are not an organization in a conventional sense, and this is kind of like the preamble here it talks about, of the word. There are no fees or dues whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. And that's important for me, honesty, an honest desire to stop drinking. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. And that's another tradition, outside issues, right? Tradition 10 talks about that. And that's why we stay unified in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I walk through the doors of AA, all my worldly titles fall off me, and I'm simply just another drunk. And so there's no politics in AA. There's no religion in AA. We're just people who want to be helpful to one another. And, you know, that keeps us united. And so, you know, it's amazing how this was put together. It's definitely divinely inspired. And when I came in here, trust me, I was not a God person. In fact, I came in as a militant atheist who damned people in their Sunday best, wouldn't step foot in a place like this. And yet I sit here only by the grace and mercy of a loving God. As I go through the process of recovery, my perception changes on organized religion. And I begin to realize some truth about why I had a resentment against organized religion. We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced to work with other alcoholics. We should like to be helpful to such cases. Inquiries by scientific, medical, and religious societies will be welcomed. And I always take my sponsees to the way, 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 way back of the book. And some stuff that maybe people don't normally read. But there's the medical view, and there's one particular paragraph on page 570. And this is from an outsider who's not an alcoholic, but these people, these men of medicine, took time to write some kind words about Alcoholics Anonymous and gave AA their blessing. So we've had a lot of outside help, people who are non-alcoholics who have helped our organization throughout its 82 years, I believe, of existence at this point. And on page 570, it's Dr. W.W. Bauer, broadcasting under the auspices of the American Medical Association in 1946 over the NBC network, said, in part, Alcoholics Anonymous are no crusaders, not a temperance society. They know that they must never drink. They help others with similar problems. In this atmosphere, this is a pretty important sentence for me, it says, in this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself. I've always been the problem, right? Learning to depend upon a higher power and absorbing himself in work with other alcoholics, he remains sober day by day. The days add up into weeks, and the weeks into months, and into years. And that's how I enlarge my spiritual life, by working with other alcoholics. You know, the 12th step for me. And it's really intensive work with another alcoholic and going through this book the way my sponsor went through with me. So I'm going to skip over to another doctor. And I see we had a guy here who's new. So I was going to start with something else, but I figured I'd change my plans on a whim. And we're going to go through the doctor's opinion tonight. And I'm going to do my best to relate my experience to the doctor's opinion. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony. Testimony. It's amazing. That's what I do when I come up here and I give my experience, strength, and hope. I'm testifying what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. Must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, a chief physician at a not nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In the late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. And this is Dr. Silkworth, and he's talking about Bill Wilson at this point, the patient that he'd come across, one of our co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. So there's that word recovered again. I'm not recovering from my obsession to drink. I've recovered from that through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch on the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth. And so that was his first attempt to appease the alcoholic community with a letter. It's going to go on to say that we think there's a little bit more to this alcoholism, and talks about the physical component. So he was kind enough to write another letter, but this is what we had come to the conclusion of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, the physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we have suffered, who we have suffered. Alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we were sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. And so, for me, the physical component of alcoholism is that even because I haven't taken a drink since October of 2009, I'm not cured of alcoholism. If I were to drink today, it would be as if I've never stopped. In fact, it would get much worse. And an abnormal reaction is what they call the allergy. So I would say things like I break out in handcuffs or you know, or things of that nature. You know, when I drink, I have the delusion that I'm gaining control. Mm-hmm. And people who are the average tempered drinker who can take it and leave it have the opposite effect that alcohol produces with them. And with them, alcohol, they feel like they're losing control, and they feel like maybe they need to stop. This is not cool. And for me, I'm like, the more I drink, the more in control I feel I am, even though on the outside, I'm probably not. I've been told many stories about what I looked like when I was drunk, when I thought I was in control. And so it's this feeling of ease and comfort. I'm going to talk about that later on in this paragraph. So for me, the physical component as an alcoholic is still there, regardless of how long I have sober. And I was at a meeting in Karlstadt on Friday, and a guy raised his hand and was coming back who drank after 40 years of recovery. 40 years. And he was just coming back, you know? And he looked like hell. So that tells me I'll never be cured of the physical component of my alcoholism. That's why I need a spiritual remedy for my dis-ease, so I don't go back to the thing that's going to kill me, which is the bottle. And Bill talks about the boomerang, that all but one day would come back and tear him to ribbons, right? And that's what it is for me. So the doctor writes, and he goes on with his letter here. He says, the subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as a medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to the alcoholic, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with all our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. So this doctor had some humility. he began to realize that that he couldn't fix us. He couldn't cure us. This is one of the most well-known hospitals for drug addiction and alcoholism, right? And he was the director of it. And here he's admitting to himself that for cases such as, like me, the hopeless alcoholic, he couldn't fix them. So I think I must have a power greater than myself, right? So he had some humility there. And he talks about his synthetic knowledge and modern standards. And back then, in the 1930s, modern standards to them was belladonna treatments and shock therapy, and it really wasn't fun to get locked up in an asylum in the 1930s if you were an alcoholic. And most of the time, that's what they did. They locked us up and threw us away, kept us out of society, and really, the alcoholic would go through torture back then. It's not that way today, thank God. So things have changed. This is many years ago. One of the leading contributors to this book, which is Bill Wilson, came under our care in this hospital. And while here, he acquired some ideas, which he put into practical application at once. And now this is, I think this is the first time they talk about a time frame for Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't say he put into practical application and sat around meetings all day and didn't drink and took up space and... It says at once, which means I probably got to do something now. there's really no need to wait to do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I have a disease that will do anything in its power to keep me from going through the process of recovery as outlined in this book. It tells me all kinds of crazy things, like the first and second step. I can do the first step. That's great. I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable, clearly. But then I look at 2 and 3 and it talks about a higher power in God. And that's where my disease starts to trip me up and tells me that I need to have a conception of this higher power before going through the rest of the steps. And that's a lie. In fact, my conception didn't come until going through the process of recovery. That's how I got my conception of my higher power. Not waiting to do a 4-step or sitting on the fence in the 1-2-3 waltz and really just sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous and rotting. There's a pamphlet called The Member's Eye View, and Bill Wilson talks about this widely misconception of AA about those who talk about just don't drink and go to meetings. And he talks about we think that something is rubbing off on us, and some think it's sobriety. And he goes on to say that what's really rubbing off on us is death. And day by day, as we sit in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, rigor mortis sets in. And eventually we die of untreated alcoholism. You see, my alcoholism is going to get treated one way or another, either with spiritual principles or with another drink. And I can be in the center of AA and still be dying of active alcoholism. The only requirement for membership to the fellowship is a desire to stop drinking, right? It says honest in the preamble. But there are far more requirements for the fellowship of the Spirit. And I think there's precisely 12 of those requirements, which I must meet on a daily basis in order to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And so at once. It doesn't mean hang out here for a year. I hear people say a step a year. I hear all kinds of crazy stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous that actually goes against what's in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's amazing. I go to some meetings, and I went through this phase, and I don't really recommend it. I had a spiritual awakening, and I was using the big book. That would become my boomerang, and that was going to be the thing that would all but cut me to ribbons because I knew better than everybody else. Boy, this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It'll use everything I think I know about this book, and separate me from the group that wants to help me, right? And, you know, so I got to give people room to recover how they want to recover, but if I see somebody struggling, I always offer my hand and the big book and the 12 steps. You know, that's kind of my job as an alcoholic in recovery, is not to just coddle people and take them back and forth to meetings. That's great, and that's a great beginning. And that's how I started some of my conversations with my sponsor, was in the car and going over the book and sitting at his kitchen table. Intensive work to me means sitting down with another alcoholic one-on-one and going through this process. And it once means to me that I'm not waiting to do that. You know, I'm not waiting 90 days to jump into the steps. I'm all or nothing kind of guy, so I was pretty badly mangled, and unfortunately, it took me about 10 months to get into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery, because I hit an emotional bottom in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And 10 meetings a week, coffee commitments up the wazoo. Right, I was Mr. AA, and I was great in the fellowship. Mm-hmm. I was a two-stepper, and about 10 months in, I hit a brick wall in my recovery, and I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. And that's when my sponsor told me the truth. He said, you keep feeling the way you're feeling, and AA is going to tell you that your disease is going to tell you that AA doesn't work. And the truth is, you haven't worked the program of recovery. He said, so either you meet me at my kitchen table, or tomorrow break your record for meetings and make 8. Let's see if that helps you. I had a record for meetings in a day of 7 in one day. I'd sit in the Perry Street Clubhouse down in Manhattan, and I'd hop on the train and go to 2 more meetings in New Jersey. And at the time, I wasn't attending to my business affairs. Instead of bar hopping, I was now meeting hopping. Mm. Right? I went to the other extreme, and actually, I lost my job. I lost my job in recovery. I got released because I wasn't doing the things I was supposed to be doing, but I wasn't drinking, right? And if nothing changes, nothing changes, right? So he goes on to say later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we considered the cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of a profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more, in a power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. And that would be my biggest fear today, is not going back out drinking, drugging, and dying. My biggest fear today would be going back out drinking, drugging, and existing in the morass of self-pity and just kind of muddling along in my life, looking for the next hit or the next bottle. Because truth be told, that was my higher power. I had many gods in my life, but I didn't know it. That became my higher power. When the money wasn't working or the relationships didn't do it for me, the bottle became my higher power. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. We believe, and so suggest a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. The phenomenon of craving is limited to these cases and never occurs in the average-tempered drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And that becomes my unmanageable piece. You know, how can a solution to all my problems be a problem? I don't get it. I have no idea. Because alcohol, for me, was my solution to what they say on page 52. And I'm going to jump over there real quick. It talks about what's really ailing me. It says we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Yep, that was me. We couldn't control our emotional nature. That's absolutely. That's why I drank for the effect produced by alcohol, because I thought it controlled my emotional nature, right? I was prey to misery and depression. I couldn't make a living. I had a feeling of uselessness. I was filled with fear. I was unhappy and couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. And that's my alcoholism to a T. You know, that's why I drank. That's why I did drugs, because I was having trouble controlling my emotional nature. I was prey to misery and depression. I couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. And that's kind of what I did. I compared your outsides to my insides, and I lost every single time. It seemed to me that everybody else had it together, but somehow, some way, I had missed the mark in this thing called life. And that's another lie. You know, I have a disease, dis-ease, that lies to me on a daily basis. And it goes on to talk about frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold the alcoholic people, these alcoholic people, must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideas must, it doesn't say we suggest, it says their ideas must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And that, to me, is a promise. And, you know, I've become the ultimate weapon against active alcoholism because of my experience as being an active drunk and my experience of being in active recovery. You know, it's the average temper drinker, the people who aren't alcoholics, who will throw the frothy emotional appeal at you, right? Because to them, they could take it or leave it. Why don't you just do this? Or why don't you just drink on the weekends? Or why don't, you know, and then, because they can do that. And I can't do that. And so a lot of these counselors that are book savvy and maybe not have the actual experience of being an active alcoholic, sometimes they can throw the frothy emotional appeal at us too. But the depth and weight that comes from another alcoholic sitting down with somebody who's suffering from alcoholism is amazing. You know, and I'm willing to tell the darkest, deepest parts of my story, every nook and cranny it talks about in the Fifth Step Promises, and because I know it's going to help somebody else. Mm-hmm. And because of the process, I'm no longer tied to my past. My past doesn't define who I am. It's merely something that happened, and it's something that I got to learn from. And that happened when I go later on through the process of recovery, primarily in inventory and the fifth step, right? It's inventory, confession, and restitution, 4 through 9. And that's what frees me up to be who God intended me to be. You know, it says, if any feel that if psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental. And this is the frothy emotional appeal. He says he can't really do anything for us, right? Let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies. Alcoholism is a family disease, and it is quite tragic. The despairing wives, the little children, let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Altruism. In order to keep what I have, I got to give it away. Hmm. Right? And there's no profit motive for me. In fact, I enjoy it today. I enjoy sitting down with another alcoholic and going through this process. And so it goes on to say why I drank, right? It says men and women drank essentially because they liked the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. Mm-hmm. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontent, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, and here comes another time frame, that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity, which means it looks like everybody else can get away with this drinking game, but I can't. Impunity without consequence. And the ease and comfort that comes at once. In fact, for me, just holding the bottle without even taking the drink. The drink had already taken me. Mm-hmm. I got the ease and comfort just knowing that in the moment that bottle was going to be open and I was going to experience my relief from life. Right? That's what I was looking for. I was looking for relief. Because I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. You know, I remember having a suit and tie job in Manhattan, the job I got let go from in recovery. I can remember managing my alcoholism. Mm-hmm. I remember having suits in the closet because I knew there was a good chance I wasn't making it to the train. I was going to pass out somewhere in the five boroughs. I'd often come to in Penn Station, bloody and disheveled, not remembering how I got there. I get the nightstick, the move it along nightstick with the police, like, move it along, buddy. I'm like sitting literally with the bums in Penn Station. And here I am in a suit and tie, right? And I'd stumble back to the office. I'd get there before anybody else got there. I'd take a suit. I often sometimes maybe even wear the same shirt, maybe get a different tie. I try to wash up in the bathroom the best I could. I was probably still reeking from the night before. And I'd look myself in the mirror, and I'd swear to myself I wasn't going to do it again today. You see, I couldn't even keep a promise to myself. Mm-hmm. That's how powerful this thing of alcoholism is. I couldn't even keep a promise to myself. Because by noon, I'd get out of the office, I'd think I'm feeling a little bit better. And obviously when I'm cold calling, I got to pass a lot of bars in Midtown Manhattan. And I often go into a bar and say I'm just going to have one, or maybe today I'm just going to have lunch, not a drink. And the tricky thing is there would be days where I could do that, right? Where I'd have the one drink, I'd make it back to the office, I'd get some work done, and I'd pat myself on the back. And I'd get on the train, I'd make it back to New Jersey, but then I'd have a problem making it back into New York for the next couple days. Because I forgot about the endless bottles of vodka in the freezer in the apartment that I'd polish off and be too sick to make it back into New York. Mm-hmm. Right? Alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It's the biggest lie. It tells me every day that maybe next time it'll be different. Because at this point in my life, I have no other solution to combat my spiritual malady. I have no other solution to get rid of the irritable, restless, discontent feeling besides alcohol. I need another solution. Thank God for God and thank God for AA. I found my solution here, right? So, after they have succumbed to the desire again, which I've done so many times, and the phenomenon of craving develops, which means that's the physical part of my alcoholism. You know, I hear people talk about they had the craving after being sober for a period of time, and that's not true at all. That's the mental obsession. That's the mind. The only way I get the craving again is if I actually physically take the drink. Then I start to crave it again because I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. Because I like what it does for me when I take a few drinks. I get that ease and comfort that comes at once, right? And so they pass through well-known stages of a spree, emerging ever remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire, which means more than half, psychic change, there is very little hope for their recovery. And unless I can experience a psychic change, there's very little hope for my recovery. Mm-hmm. And it goes on to give me a promise in the next paragraph, which I like. It says, on the other hand, and as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, that was me, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, that was me, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. Mm-hmm. And then it says, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Necessary and required. Doesn't say suggested. It's a little bit different verbiage in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes I hear a frothy emotional appeal, and this is my ego again, right? Here I am on the pedestal judging. I hear frothy emotional appeal at some AA meetings I go to. Like, just pat you on the back and say, keep coming, right? And I've been guilty of that, and to me, that's just laziness, right? That's like me passing the buck. Keep coming, buddy. Maybe you'll get a sponsor. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody will take you through this process, but it's not going to be me. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've been guilty of doing that at times myself. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we find the froth and emotional appeal in AA meetings. That's been my experience sometimes. So I need to follow a few simple rules. And the rules for me are outlined in this book, and it's going to go on further. I mean, they spend an awful lot of time in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to convince the reader whether or not they're alcoholic. I mean, it's, what, 50 plus pages of really the first three steps, and giving examples so somebody can come to their own conclusion whether or not they're alcoholic, because I can't tell somebody else they're alcoholic. That's a self-diagnosis, right? And so it gives me a lot of examples. And so that's a promise to me. On the other hand, you know, if I follow some rules, and as an alcoholic, I don't like rules, but spiritual disciplines and obedience, for me, you know, my alcoholism thinks about required and necessary, and my sickness and my disease thinks about discipline as restriction. Because I'm so self-centered, I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And if I had restrictions, then I couldn't do that, right? But the truth is, if I'm obedient to spiritual principles, there are no restrictions. I'm actually liberated. I am free to do what I need to do or what I want to do, right? So what happens for me over time is my perception changes. And spiritual obedience to me is necessary, and following a few simple rules is necessary so I can actually have freedom. And it's like an oxymoron, right? It doesn't make sense. Well, how does that work? Practice it enough over time, and you begin to realize these things, right? So it says, men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power... I mean, they say this a lot in this book, right? I need a power greater than myself to recreate my life. My life must be grounded in a higher power, right? It says this a lot, right? Must have something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorable to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all their interests, so that that the important appointment was not met. Mm-hmm. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And that's, again, once again, the physical component of my dis-ease. And in business, as a salesperson, I've experienced that. You know, I had an appointment to close a huge deal, and I thought I would stop for lunch before going to that appointment, and I never made that appointment, and therefore I never closed that huge deal. And and you know, it was always somebody else's fault, right? It was never my fault. You know, I played a blame game a lot in my alcoholism. So I've actually personally experienced that, where I've thrown away an opportunity to advance my career, you know, to get the accolades I always wanted. I was always looking for accolades and validation growing up, right? I looked for it with my mother. I looked for it in other people. You know, I need people to validate me because I'm insecure about myself. And and I had trust issues, and I was friends with everyone and close to no one, arm's length, and that's part of my spiritual malady, right? There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going in the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. And I can identify with that type. I made many resolutions, especially towards the end of my drinking, but never a decision. And for me, decision has to follow, an action has to follow my decision. And I said I didn't want to drink, but what would happen, I'd make that decision, but my action would actually go against the decision I just made, because without alcohol, I'm in trouble. again, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent, right? There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes the brand or his environment. There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is, perhaps, the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter can be written. And for me, that's kind of the outline of my alcoholism, because in the beginning, I was unwilling to admit that I had a problem with alcohol in the beginning, in the very beginning. Again, because it was my solution. Right? So I was unwilling to give up that solution that gave me ease and comfort. I'd planned various ways. I've changed the brand or the environment. And thank God I haven't been convinced that if I'm entirely free from alcohol for a period, I can take a drink without danger. In fact, when I went to that meeting in Karlstad on Friday afternoon, and the gentleman was coming back with 40 years, that was a convincer to me that it doesn't matter how long I have in recovery. Alcohol to me is poison, and it will kill me slowly. Then there are types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, and friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. And that's the deal for me. That's how I know I'm alcoholic, because I can't pick up a drink without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Right? Entire abstinence. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partly recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. And 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. And that's what happens. The old person dies, and a new person emerges through this process of recovery. And there's actually a set of promises that kind of coincide with that I want to share with you guys. And it's actually one of my favorite set of promises. It's right before the third step on page 63. And it talks about what happens when I sincerely take a position. And to me, to sincerely take a position means I'm going to sit down with a sponsor and go through this process. That's my decision. And when I take that position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what I needed if I kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, I became less and less interested in myself, my little plans and designs. More and more became interested in seeing what I can contribute to life. As I felt new power flow in, as I enjoyed peace of mind, as I discovered I could face life successfully, as I became conscious of his presence, I begin to lose my fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. I was reborn. And that's a powerful paragraph for me. And it talks about, you know, getting outside myself. If I kept close to him and performed his work well, which to me means my primary purpose is stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety, primarily to help somebody else achieve sobriety. Mm-hmm. You know, I lose interest in myself, my little plans and my designs. I became more interested in seeing what I can contribute to life. I never was seeing what I can contribute to life because I was in fear that I didn't have enough to contribute, right? Mm-hmm. I was in fear that I was going to run out of something. You know, I was in fear that it was never going to be enough. So I was a taker from life rather than a contributor. Mm-hmm. You know, I took because I'm going to run out. Mm-hmm. And really, for me, that's lack of faith. You know, I don't have trust and reliance upon God in my life at that point. Because I don't trust the fact that if I give, I'm going to receive. Mm-hmm. So as I contribute to life, as I can carry out my primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, the rest of my life over the past 8+ years seems to have been taken care of for me. You know, I don't struggle. I take it easy. I pause. If I made a list of what my life would look like back in 2009 when I came in here, I surely would have sold myself short. Mm-hmm. I could have never dreamed or imagined the way things have unfolded over the past 8 years to be where I'm at in this moment right now. Forget my little plans and designs. You know, I have a beautiful fiance. Mm. I wasn't marriage material when I was out there, I can tell you that much. My son, our son, just turned 6 months yesterday. I have a stepdaughter who's in second grade, or I take her to school in the morning. I have a daughter who's going to be a freshman in high school next year from a previous relationship, which I get along with my ex. There's no courts involved. My ex actually gets along with my fiance. and life is good because I keep God and AA first, and I try to the best of my ability to apply these spiritual principles in every aspect of my life. Not perfectly. Step 10 doesn't say if I make mistakes, right? Step 10 says when. When. Which means I can be the big book thumper of the century. I can quote this book, big book backwards and forwards. I can know it like nobody's business. I can sound real great in the meaning of Alcoholics Anonymous. But ask my fiance how sober I am. Right? And so I practice these principles in all my affairs. But my life today is unrecognizable from what it was in October of 2009. And that's because I continue to let go and let go. So that's more than enough out of me for now. I think I'm going to be back next week. So I'll continue on our journey next week. And with that, that's all I have to share. Thank you guys for allowing me to come out. Thank you.